听力课堂，听 class.com
英语口译综合能力三级，第三盒。
Unit 5 A
Part 1 A Today, multinational corporations can move capital thousands of miles and send jobs halfway around the globe with the click of a mouse. These companies, many of them American,search the globe for the lowest possible labor costs and weakest environmental safeguards. Often, they get help from undemocratic governments that compete in the global marketplace by refusing to protect their citizens from environmental degradation and workplace abuse, ranging from below survival wages to physical attacks. That's the ugly reality of today's global economy. In fact,Free trade agreements, like NAFTA, have cost hundreds of thousands of American jobs since 1993 and have eroded the bargaining power of workers. The assets of the world's three richest people exceed the total incomes of the 600 million people living in the world's poorest 48 countries. The U.S. trade deficit in goods, more than an astonishing $430 billion in 2000,threatens the economic future of every American family. Each day, some 250 million children around the world go to work rather than to school. Under current World Trade Organization rules, it's easier to punish a country for violating patent laws than for sending children to work instead of to school. The WTO says that environmental and public health measures should be the least trade restrictive possible, that is,The free flow of goods takes precedence over social objectives. Because work other than prison labor is not covered by WTO rules, countries may not withdraw trade preferences from WTO members even for appalling violations of workers' rights.
B. 1. Despite rising energy prices, inflation and inflation expectations remain contained.2. As factories close, building stops, and business declines, migrant laborers find their services excessive to requirements. 3. The authorities are troubled by the prospect of overcrowded prisons and a lack of resources to block new waves of illegal immigrants. 4. The increasingly dramatic shifts in economic activityare particularly hard on the public's confidence. 5. The improved information and production controls are evident in the new economy. 6. There has been a gradual shift in the nation's labor force from agriculture to manufacturing and other non-agricultural pursuits. 7.Only after scientific knowledge is communicated to applied scientists and practitioners can it be used to benefit society. 8. In the years following 1820, the U.S. economy entered a period of extremely rapid growth that continued to the end of the 19th century. 9.American steel workers have seen their jobs swept away by a flood of dumped imports. 10. The global economy has enriched corporations through abuse of working people and the environment.
Part 2. The great debate on globalization is in full swing. Is it a threat to jobs? What are the benefits and what is the downside?It is believed that the emergence of a global market economy will bring unprecedented prosperity to millions. But the right balance needs to be found between rules and freedom if the global economy is to realize its full potential. Globalization has made the world economy more efficient and has created hundreds of millions of jobs, mainly, but not only, in developing countries.It generates an upward spiral of jobs and prosperity for countries that embrace the process, although the advantages will not reach everybody at the same time. However, Globalization requires a framework of rules as the foundation of a sound global economic order. Examples are rules to secure market access for foreign goods and services, and to protect intellectual property rights and foreign investment. While more reliance on free enterprise, open markets, and more competition reduces the need for detailed government regulation, governments must still provide the political and economic stability domestic entrepreneurs and foreign investors look for. An international rules-based structure is required to provide the stability, transparency, and predictability which business needs to operate at global level. Some rules may be set by international organizations like the WTO. Others may be based on voluntary agreements or business self-regulation.
Part 3, Passage 1. New information and communication technologies are driving the global economy. They have brought down the cost of global communication, and innovative tools have become easier to use. The Internet, mobile phones, and electronic funds transfer are opening up the global marketplace. The Internet had more than 140 million users in the middle of 1998, but 93% of users were in the richest 20% of nations. Improved communication can foster great advances in healthcare and education. It also breaks down barriers of size, time, and distance. With the Internet, consumers can purchase products from any country in the world, and any innovative producers can easily reach a much larger marketplace and take advantage of economies of scale. Improvements in technology also bring up the issue of intellectual property rights. Tighter property rights are increasing the price of technology transfer, blocking many developing countries from their use, whether it is in production, communication, education, or healthcare. This in turn increases the power and wealth of those who largely own the property rights. What is more, new information and communication technologies have also promoted the international movement of labor. This movement has been growing since the 1960s. Now, about 2.3% of the world population live outside their country of birth, and 1.5% of the world's workforce works in countries other than those of its citizenship. This trend is on the increase with the World Wide Web opening the door for skilled individuals to apply for positions in almost any country in the world. In developing countries, students are studying subjects that will give them a passage from their current existence to one of expected wealth in a rich nation. This brain drain will accelerate as the global economy expands.
Passage 2. Since the end of World War II, the level of global trade has been growing dramatically. The rate of growth in world trade doubled from 9% in the 1960s to 20% in the 1970s. It continued to grow by 5% in the 1980s, and by over 6% in the 1990s. Despite a slowdown after 1997 due to the Asian economic crisis, world trade grew by 12.4% in the year 2000, but fell by 1.4% in 2001. The growth in export volumes in advanced economies averaged 6% per year in the 1990s, compared to 8% for developing economies. A similar pattern occurred in regard to import growth. While this might seem positive, it has been found that the richest 20% of nations have 82% of the goods and services exported in the world. This compares to only 1% for the poorest 20% of nations. A major concern for developing economies is their terms of trade, i.e., the relative prices of exports compared to imports. The terms of trade for developing economies fell on average by 0.8% per year compared to an increase of 0.2% per year in advanced economies during the 1990s. while trade is increasing in the developing countries, the decline in the terms of trade can lead to a greater debt burden for the developing economies and increased income transfers to advanced economies. Faster than world trade is the growth of international direct investment. Annual outflows of foreign direct investment expanded more than 30 times to reach $1,270 billion at the end of the two decades to 2000. And the stock of direct investment has more than trebled in the last 15 years. There are approximately 60,000 transnational corporations with over 500,000 foreign affiliates. They account for about one quarter of total global output, and production of foreign affiliates currently exceeds the level of world trade by 1.3 times.
Passage 3. In the early 1990s, a slowdown in economic growth, especially in Japan and Europe, depressed investment and its expected rate of return in industrial countries. Despite this business cycle, global financial integration proceeded so that surplus funds from developed economies spilled over to selected developing economies called emerging markets. Unfortunately, these markets were not ready for accepting these huge capital inflows. Therefore, once a currency crisis broke out in Thailand in 1997, international investors' confidence in emerging markets in general was lost, so that foreign capital, particularly bank loans and portfolio investment, abruptly ran out of these markets. Nevertheless, macroeconomic indicators in the crisis-hit economies in East Asia began to show recovery, except for Indonesia in 1999, supported by their competitive exchange rates and great demand in their export markets. Sustained capital inflow, mainly foreign direct investment, also helped make room for expansionary policies. As to a macroeconomic recovery process, Korea is a top runner, where the economy has been led by demand expansion through monetary and fiscal measures, as well as exports and private consumption since late 1998. This is also the case in Thailand and Malaysia, where expansionary monetary and fiscal stances have been adopted. But there has been no remarkable progress of structural reforms, which is regarded as preconditions for economic recovery. In contrast, China did not show such a significant economic downturn as in the crisis-hit economies. Yet, their currency depreciation and economic slowdown began to affect China through trade and capital flows in 1998, although with the help of large-scale fiscal expansion, China realized nearly 8% of economic growth that year. Thereafter, even with renminbi overvaluation somewhat relaxed, China has been put into a deflationary situation where domestic demand, both private consumption and investment, is weak, with large unemployment and possible danger of capital outflow. Structural reforms in financial as well as corporate sectors have become more serious and urgent in China than elsewhere in East Asia.
Part 4. In the 1987 crash, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average, DJIA, dropped 22.6% in one day, October 19th, on volume of 608 million shares, 6 times the normal volume then, current normal daily volume is about 1.6 billion shares, the U.S. Federal Reserve, under its newly installed chairman, Alan Greenspan, with merely 9 weeks in the powerful post, flooded the banking system with new reserves. He accomplished this by having the Fed Open Market Committee, FOMC, buy massive quantities of government securities from the market, and announced the next day that the Fed would serve as liquidity to support the economic and financial system. He created $12 billion of new bank reserves by buying up government securities. The $12 billion injection of high-power money in one day caused the Fed funds rate to fall by 0.75 point and halted the financial panic, though it did not cure the financial problem. If the government had been running a balanced budget in previous times, and there were no government notes outstanding to be bought, the economy would have seized up, rather than merely falling into a recession. This shows that government deficits and sovereign debt are part and parcel of the modern financial architecture. Greenspan built his reputation by his release of a single-sentence statement that said he would supply all the liquidity the banking system needed to stay afloat during the 1987 crash. He pumped billions of U.S. dollars, a fiat currency that he could print at will, into U.S. financial institutions by pushing down the overnight lending rate aggressively. Greenspan's move flooded financial markets with money, which helped preserve liquidity and restore confidence in the U.S. financial system. But it started the bubble economy of the 1990s, which ended in Asia on July 2, 1997. Greenspan, in essence, did the same thing in 1998 and again after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. Greenspan will go down in history as the central banker who revived moral hazard, a fatal virus in any banking system. There is nothing wrong with deficit financing to keep the economy humming by smoothing out conventional business cycles. But providing liquidity to keep an undisciplined banking system afloat is another matter. It is an indulgence that the Fed itself has been criticizing the Bank of Japan, BOJ, for doing. The trouble is that the Fed under Greenspan thinks the banking system is the whole economy, or at least the part that really counts, and that the banking system should be or can be helped by risking the fundamentals of the economy. Greenspan is a permissive regulator who encourages systemic risk as an engine of growth by offering to bail out financial excesses that translate into unsustainable systemic risk. Former President Ronald Reagan attacked the wrong target when he said that government does not make money, only the private sector does. Money is created only by government, which makes money through the issuance of sovereign credit to allow the money economy to operate. Banks, despite popular misconception, do not make money. They merely keep a percentage of the cash flow for their intermediary role, as a reward for channeling the money toward productive uses. When banks fail by indiscriminate lending to keep money productive, they deserve to be punished with losses. In fact, the health of the financial system depends on the fair punishment of wayward banks to avoid a moral hazard. It is a rule that the Fed under Greenspan seems to have forgotten. One of the main causes of the 1987 crash, as explained by tax economists, was a threat by the House Ways and Means Committee to eliminate the tax deduction for interest expenses incurred in corporate takeovers. That explains the downside if one buys the theory, but it does not explain the volatility. The DJIA experienced its largest one-day percentage drop in history, 508 points, or 22.61%, on October 19, 1987, which caused volume to surge to an unprecedented 604 million shares. The next day, volume reached 608 million shares.
Unit 5. B.
Part 1. A. The global economy is not working for millions of working women around the world. The rules of the global economy make it possible for companies to chase the lowest wages and highest profits, regardless of the consequences for people and communities. Companies are turning to women and girls to cut their labor costs and increase their profits. Today, women make up 45% of the world's workforce, yet they account for 70% of the world's population living in poverty. Most women throughout the world are forced to take up low-skilled, low-wage jobs. Their work often is dangerous. And women are likely to face additional threats on the job, such as discrimination, sexual harassment, physical abuse, and pregnancy exams as a condition of work. 90% of the 27 million workers in export processing zones are women, most of them between the ages of 16 and 25. These zones are tax-free industrial areas for foreign companies in which labor laws often are suspended and workers unprotected. In Mexico, women who work in the factories in the export processing zones are subjected to numerous forms of violence, including murder. Even in developed countries, such as the United States, women are working longer hours and making less money than men. Without rules to protect basic rights, such as the freedom of association and an end to discrimination and child labor, working women are denied the opportunity to feed their families and contribute to their communities. In 10 years, 80% of all women in industrialized countries and 70% of all women globally will work outside of the home. We need rules for the global economy that work for working women.
B. 1. Globalization without a social dimension allows unprincipled employers to profit from exploiting children. 2. Confidence has been under extraordinary pressure in recent months due to rising energy prices and weaker stock prices. 3. Consumers and business literally freeze up due to the heightened economic uncertainty. 4. Real GDP will grow by between 2% and 2.5% between the fourth quarter of last year and the fourth quarter of this year. 5. The government estimates unemployment has already doubled to about 8.7%. 6. That island country has withdrawn its apparent welcome for illegal immigrants. 7. The Singaporean and Malaysian currencies have devalued far less than the Indonesian rupiah. 8. The worth of Jewish assets stolen by the Nazis during World War II has been estimated at about $14 billion in 1945 dollars, or about $140 billion in 1998. 9. The lower stock prices are having a great impact due to the dramatic increase in stock wealth since the mid-1990s. 10. Swiss banks are internationally famous for their secrecy and confidentiality.
Part 2. The globalization of business investment and capital markets has increased the need for high-quality financial information. It is widely agreed, for example, that doubts about the reliability of corporate financial statements in some nations contributed to the breadth and depth of the financial crises in recent years affecting Asia, Latin America, and Russia. At the same time, business enterprises would benefit from a common approach to financial reporting that is characterized by consistency, coherence, and ease of implementation and understanding. There is a substantial gap between the quality of the financial information available in many countries and the reasonable expectations of the users of this information. Closing the gap should be a priority issue for all actors in the international financial marketplace: buyers, sellers, investors, lenders, borrowers, regulators, finance ministries, and central banks. Success would mean not only improved transparency and greater comparability and reliability of financial information, but also, very likely, a reduction in the cost of capital and diminished burdens on business. The changes are necessary at national and international levels so that all general-purpose financial information may be prepared according to a single worldwide framework using common measurement criteria and requiring fair and comprehensive disclosure. The framework must provide users with a transparent representation of the underlying economics of transactions and must be applied rigorously and consistently.
Part 3, Passage 1. It is now clear that the increase in production potential that the IT revolution will bring about will not be limited to IT-related industries, but will extend to the overall economy. First of all, the IT revolution can increase the rate of growth of the capital stock by stimulating active IT-related investment. This kind of investment leads to increasingly sophisticated IT technology being built into capital and, accordingly, raises the quality of capital as well. More importantly, by increasing the speed with which information is disseminated and shared inside and outside corporations, the IT revolution can drastically alter the combination of capital and labor, bring about greater efficiency in conducting business, facilitate corporate restructuring, and thus lead to productivity increases that cannot be attributed to either capital or labor. For instance, it can reduce the need for intermediary business, make inventory management more efficient, and enable businesses to obtain inputs in the business-to-business market that is networked globally. In addition to the supply side, the IT revolution will have effects on the demand side through increased IT-related investment, expansion of demand for IT-related services, and the development of new consumer-oriented services, including business-to-consumer electronic commerce and electronic financial transactions. A two-way flow of information between business and consumers made possible through the Internet can generate new types of demand and new business opportunities. Benefits will increase dramatically as the number of users increases. Costs will be reduced and profits will increase as the market grows in size. These are likely to contribute to the further expansion of demand. As a result of this accelerated growth potential on the supply side, in parallel with expansion on the demand side, IT can contribute to stronger growth. Like many other technological innovations, IT may bring job losses in certain areas, but create jobs in IT-related businesses. Overall, we can expect a positive impact on employment due to stronger economic growth.
Passage 2. The WTO, or the World Trade Organization, is an international body that promotes and enforces the provisions of trade laws and regulations. It has the authority to administer and police new and existing free trade agreements, to oversee world trade practices, and to settle trade disputes among member states. It was established in 1994 to replace GATT, or the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, a treaty and international trade organization. The WTO began operation on January 1, 1995. GATT and the WTO coexisted until December 1995, when the members of GATT met for the last time. Although the WTO replaced GATT, the trade agreements established by GATT in 1994 are part of the WTO agreement. However, the WTO has a significantly broader scope than the GATT. GATT regulated trade in merchandise goods. The WTO expanded the GATT agreement to include trade in services, such as protection for intellectual property. The WTO is also a formally structured organization whose rules are legally binding on its member states. It provides a framework for international trade law. Members can refer trade disputes to the WTO for settlement by a dispute panel composed of WTO officials. Members can appeal this panel's rulings to a WTO appellate body whose decisions are final. Disputes must be resolved within the time limit set by WTO rules. As of 1996, almost all of the 123 nations that had signed the new GATT Pact had transferred membership to the WTO, including the United States. About 30 other nations had also applied for membership. The WTO is based in Geneva, Switzerland, and is controlled by a general council made up of member states' ambassadors who also serve on various subsidiary and specialist committees. The Ministerial Conference, which meets every 2 years and appoints the WTO's Director General, oversees the General Council.
Passage 3. The global economy is leaving millions of dissatisfied workers in its train. Growing income inequality, job insecurity, unemployment, and poverty have become widespread. Rapid technological change and heightening international competition are destroying the job markets of the major industrialized countries. At the same time, systemic pressures are weakening every government's ability to respond with new spending. Just when working people most need their country as a protection from the world economy, it is abandoning them. This is not how things were supposed to work. The failure of today's advanced global capitalism to keep spreading the wealth poses a challenge not just to policymakers, but to modern economics and science as well. For generations, students were taught that increasing trade and investment, coupled with technological change, would drive national productivity and create wealth. Yet, over the past decade, despite the continuing boom in international trade and finance, productivity has fallen, and inequality in the United States and unemployment in Europe have worsened. If the post-World War II social contract with workers of full employment and comprehensive social welfare is to be broken, political support for the rising global economy could easily collapse. For international economic integration is not some uncontrollable fact of life, but has deepened because of a series of policy decisions taken by the major industrial powers over the last 45 years. It is time to recognize that those decisions, while benefiting the world economy as a whole, have begun to have widespread negative consequences. The forces acting on today's workers are just a natural part of the structure of today's global economy, with its open and increasingly fierce competition on the one hand, and fiscally conservative units, states, on the other. Countermeasures, therefore, must also be deep, sustained, and widespread. Easing pressures on the losers of the new open economy must now be the focus of economic policy, if the process of globalization is to be sustained.
Part 4. The annual publications of lists of the world's wealthiest people and richest corporations have always received extensive publicity. Generally speaking, our culture typically lifts the wealthy to lofty levels of respect and admiration. We envy them, and even most of the critically minded among us have become so tolerant of wealth. The rich are our adored sports and movie stars, business leaders, politicians, and pop heroes, and that fact reflects how little we as a culture recognize the profound social and moral ugliness of wealth. Wealth is power. On one level, this seems obvious, but on another level, it is a fact that has become largely neglected and forgotten in our society. Many of us tend to think that wealth is money. We imagine that cash has some sort of objective power, and that a person or company or nation can miraculously accumulate large quantities of it without being deliberately exploitive and repressive of others. It's almost as if we imagine that accumulating wealth merely involves gathering lots of loose paper together and then innocently bathing in it. Many even consider it to be ethically good, because when you're rich, you'll spend a lot of your time giving people work and buying people's products. How charitable and socially productive of you, really. However, the real problem lies in the fact that wealth is power. Wealth is not an objective concept. It only has meaning insofar as it represents demonstrable power over other people. Your money is worth something because you can purchase products made by people or pay for services offered by people. You could have $1 million, but if I'm so economically comfortable myself that I'll only help repair the roof of your house if you give me $500,000, what worth does your money have to you? But if I'm so hungry and have so much competition from other hungry people that I'm willing to lower my price to 50 cents, well then, you're very comfortably rich. So in order to create wealth in even a relatively small group of people, a society has to create extreme poverty in a very large group of people. You simply cannot have one without the other. Your wealth is measured by the degree of poverty of the people around you. As wealth increases, so must poverty increase. This is why the promise of cheap and efficient modern technologies to free the world of poverty and starvation has never borne out. No matter how efficient our technology becomes, creating wealth still requires creating poverty. And this widespread misunderstanding of wealth is now dominating the political landscape of North America. During these days of spreading poverty, there is growing hot debate about what our government should be doing financially to create broader economic wealth, even while the government itself is descending critically into debt and poverty. Unfortunately, the debates usually center around money issues, but they should actually be focused on issues of power. The real question is, how can it be that the government has actually become just a struggling small player in the nation's economic game? If the government is in debt and short of cash, where will its power go? And the answer, of course, is that a relatively small group of people and organizations operating within the country have become more economically wealthy and powerful than the government of the country. And it doesn't have to be this way, but we're continuing to let it happen because we respect wealth, instead of seeing it as the dangerous, destructive, and corrupt disease that it is. So, if we truly want to end poverty and powerlessness, wealth needs to be made illegal.